This program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Laura, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 30th issue of the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Robert Irwin is actually that nice. His story began with loss, but the lessons of his crocodile hunter father helped Irwin spread a message of love as he won season 34 of Dancing with the Stars by Ashley Spencer. Inside the Huntington Botanical Gardens, a leafy oasis amid the concrete sprawl of Los Angeles County, a hawk snatched a baby squirrel from its nest, much to the horror of onlookers. On a commercial flight, a wayward bee buzzed through the cabin, causing mayhem among the passengers. In both instances, Robert Irwin happened to be nearby. Wherever I go, whenever there's anything animal-related, it's like when Clark Kent takes his little glasses off, he said. It's like, okay, I can step in and handle this. Not all heroes wear capes. Sometimes they wear khaki. Mr. Irwin caught the bee, but the squirrel could not be saved. I felt really bad, but, I mean, that's nature, isn't it? He said. Best day ever for the hawk, worst day ever for the squirrel. The son of Steve Irwin, the beloved crocodile hunter conservationist, who died in 2006, Mr. Irwin has continued his father's work, promoting wildlife at home in Australia and around the world, while doing things his own way. As a contestant on Dancing with the Stars this fall, Mr. Irwin, who turns 22 next month, became a fan favorite from his very first jungle-themed jive. And that carried through right up until the end, as he and his partner Whitney Carson were crowned the champions of season 34 during the show's season finale, which aired live on Tuesday night. None of that was much of a surprise. He told his sister Bindi Irwin, won the ABC reality show's Mirror Ball Trophy in 2015, and it was clear that, like his sister, the endlessly upbeat Mr. Irwin had also inherited his father's ability to connect with people. The judges, fans, children, celebrities, even Prince William called into the show to offer Mr. Irwin his support. Robert is like living sunshine, Ms. Irwin, 27, said. Wherever he goes, he makes people feel better. Or as his mother, Terry Irwin, put it, he's kind of what Tom Cruise aspires to be. When I first met Mr. Irwin inside his Dancing with the Stars trailer in Los Angeles in mid-November, his khaki workout pants were peppered with jagged rips, not from a wayward animal encounter, but from aggressive knee sliding across the dance floor. I'm held together with tape and a prayer at this point, he said. I feel like I'm at my limit, and I wouldn't want it any other way. Though athletic, Mr. Irwin had zero dance experience before joining the hit series. He approached the competition with a dogged determination that helped him take home the title. Since September, the finalists, a group that also includes the Olympic gymnast Jordan Chiles, the actress Elaine Hendricks, and the content creators Alex Earl and Dylan Efron, have spent 24 to 36 hours a week in rehearsals with their professional dance partners. Mr. Irwin was paired with Ms. Carson, a professional dancer who in 2014 won the competition with Alfonso Ribeiro, who is now one of the show's hosts. On a recent Monday evening, I watched Mr. Irwin practice his foxtrot inside the Dancing with the Stars ballroom, technically a cavernous soundstage, near Hollywood. His mother and sister sat a few rows back. The family, along with his sister's husband and four-year-old daughter, decamped to Los Angeles for the show's entire season to support Mr. Irwin at his request. As cameras prepared for the blocking sessions and producers conferred, Mr. Irwin twirled across the polished floor, his arms wrapped around an imaginary partner, his patent loafers following a silent beat. "I just want to get this right," he told Miss Carson as she slipped into position and they retraced the movements yet again. At the next night's live show, while the other contestants chatted and stretched, Mr. Irwin was back at it, furiously dancing parts of his routine until a crew member shooed him into place. "He puts so much pressure on himself," Miss Carson told me inside her trailer. "He's a perfectionist. He just puts his heart and soul into everything and makes you want to be better." Throughout the season, the two leaned into Mr. Irwin's budding status as a heartthrob, outfitting him in torso-bearing ensembles and integrating the occasional body roll and hip thrust into his choreography. Yet, there's a softer side to his appeal. Mr. Irwin isn't afraid of raw emotion, and he broke down multiple times during the season. One night, he cried during a dance dedicated to his mother, who raised him and his sister alone after his father was fatally stung by a stingray. Another time, he fell to the floor, overcome with emotion, when videos of him and his father were shown. Fans, and there are many, have praised Mr. Irwin as a beacon of positive masculinity for his vulnerability. He makes no attempt to appear cool or aloof. He often throws his head back in full-throated laughter, and he gleefully celebrates everyone around him. He has also expressed his support of the LGBTQ community and women's health issues. He said he was inspired by his sister's endometriosis diagnosis. "I strongly believe that life is too short not to wear your heart on your sleeve," he said. "When you lose someone important early on, it reaffirms the fact that life is so fleeting. You owe it to yourself to find your passion and pursue it." For Mr. Irwin, that sensitivity is a strength he first saw in his father, who died when Mr. Irwin was 2, and to whom he bears a striking resemblance, both in exuberant mannerisms and blonde, rugged physicality. He was about as traditionally masculine as you can get, and then, at the same time, he was the most vulnerable, emotional, family-oriented, kind human being, he said. "That, to me, is the epitome." The actor Russell Crowe, who has been a close friend of the Irwins since the 1990s, said Steve would be so impressed with the man his son has become and how he had succeeded on the ballroom journey. Although Steve could read the rhythms of the seasons and every living creature, he was absolutely not gifted with a sense of musical rhythm, Mr. Crowe said in an email. In his hands, a tambourine became a deadly weapon. He added, "I think he would watch Robert dancing and how he uses his body, the strength and poise, and he would be in awe of his son." Australia does not have its own royal family, but the Irwins could be considered the closest thing. In lieu of a palace, Mr. Irwin was raised in a zoo. In 1970, the elder Mr. Irwin's parents founded a small reptile park that evolved into Australia Zoo in Birrawa, Queensland. After he began managing the park and married his wife, who is American, in the early 1990s, they settled in a home on the site as they expanded the zoo and collaborated on The Crocodile Hunter. When he died, his wife made sure he remained ever present in their children's lives through his extensive catalog of work. The children watched episodes of The Crocodile Hunter and other documentaries featuring their father every morning with breakfast. "We had thousands upon thousands of hours of footage, so I never felt like I was missing the picture of who my dad was," Robert Irwin said. "Put it this way, I learned how to feed crocodiles from my dad," he added, explaining that he first tried it 8 years after his father's death, with guidance from the videos and other zookeepers who his father had personally trained. "He is still teaching me every day." While growing up, the privately tutored Irwin children made time for typical 2000s kid things. Their mother said Bindi had a Tamagotchi, and Robert had a Game Boy. But they were mostly free-range kids who climbed trees and traipsed around the zoo. The elder Miss Irwin is now the zoo's sole owner, and she, her son, and her daughter's family all live on the 700-acre property. They regularly appear there to promote their conservation and animal rehabilitation work, and have found other promotional avenues like reality TV, merchandise, luxury lodgings, and nonprofit efforts. "It's like I was born into a Disney movie," Mr. Irwin said. "I wake up every morning to the sound of the lemurs and tigers calling. I'm surrounded by animals, and I'm surrounded by all of this love from my family and this drive to want to make the world a better place." At a backlot photo shoot the morning after Mr. Irwin earned a perfect score for his foxtrot, he vibrated with pent-up energy as he made small talk about the merits of monotremes, egg-laying mammals like the platypus. When he had to pose for a few serious shots, his lips quivered as he tried to suppress his signature toothy grin. "It's my default," he said, as his smile won the battle. Mr. Irwin's overreaching message, like that of the rest of his family, is simple. Treat others, whether they be humans or animals, with kindness. Someone once said, "Steve's like the Gandhi of wildlife," the elder Miss Irwin said, adding that her husband's mantra was, "You've got to love crocodiles and koalas, vultures and eagles." As in, the prickly or overlooked animals deserve adoration too. "Once you're accepting like that, it just kind of cuts through your whole life," she said. "More to love." Over the course of the 3 days I spent intermittently trailing and observing Mr. Irwin at various Dancing with the Stars activities, his puppy-like excitement for anyone and anything that crossed his path never appeared to waver. But no one can really be that enthusiastic all the time, right? "I used to think that," said Luke Raverley, the general manager of Australia Zoo, who has known Mr. Irwin since he was a toddler. "But it's him. On and off the camera. He's like that 24/7. Perhaps because Mr. Irwin has been in the spotlight since birth, a camera crew filmed him as a newborn in the delivery room, and 4 weeks later he was at the center of an international uproar when his father cradled him in one arm while feeding a crocodile. He doesn't see any distinction between his public persona and his private self. I never change what I say, what I do, who I am, one bit, wherever I am," he said, as we sat on a couch in an empty green room before a fresh round of rehearsals. "It's just me, and I stand by who I am." "The challenge with that," he conceded, "is that you've got no persona to hide behind." Instead, he has become an expert at revealing just enough. No matter his audience, Mr. Irwin is disarmingly friendly and welcoming. But every word is spoken with intention. Every answer bounces in exactly the direction he wishes it to take. He is a publicist dream. Topics like his struggles with fame and his dating life are spoken about in broad terms, his cheerful tone belying the wall of privacy he has delicately constructed. "Holy moly, that's so challenging to navigate," he said, "of trying to date in an era where anything you do will be on TikTok the next day." He was previously in a relationship with the niece of Heath Ledger, and dancing fans love to speculate about various dating rumors. When I asked his family if Mr. Irwin had ever rebelled, Bindi quipped, "His paleontology phase was pretty wild." In Australia, he unwinds by surfing in the Pacific Ocean most mornings. He considers himself a spiritual person, and he finds the most solace from being in nature. "That's my meditation," he said. "It's my church. It's my everything." Now Mr. Irwin's at a crossroads. With his Dancing with the Stars journey complete, he will head to South Africa, where he hosts the Australian version of "I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here," a gig he committed to only after the series agreed to stop serving native wildlife in its eating challenges. But his stint as a dancing star has opened up a new world, he said, one in which he sees a future more rooted in the arts and working, at least part-time, in the United States. To that end, he has a cameo in Disney's Zootopia 2 as a koala named Robert Furwin, and he dreams of one day starring in action movies. Mate, 100%, he said, his eyes lighting up at the thought of doing stunts. Oh my gosh, that would be an absolute dream. He'll never move away from wildlife conservation or the zoo, he explained carefully, but he is hoping to evolve the ways in which he spreads his message. What I represent is still so deeply connected to anything I do, he said. Even if I'm not in there catching crocodiles, the khaki is still in my heart. It's always me. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The world's largest afro took 3 people to measure it. With an afro that is more than 6 feet in circumference, Jessica Martinez set a new Guinness record. By Alicia Haradasani Gupta. Jessica Martinez was about 12 years old when she stopped using relaxers for her textured hair. In the roughly 2 decades since, her hair has flourished into a bountiful afro, the largest one in the world, in fact. On Wednesday, Guinness World Records announced that Ms. Martinez, 29, had officially set a new mark for a woman with an afro that measures 190 centimeters, around 6 feet 3 inches, in circumference, surpassing Avon Dugas, who in 2010 had set the previous record of 165 centimeters, around 5 feet 5 inches. Last month, an adjudicator from Guinness visited Ms. Martinez to measure her hair. He couldn't do it by himself and needed 2 extra pairs of hands, Ms. Martinez said. Breaking the record felt significant for Ms. Martinez, who works at a criminal justice nonprofit organization in New York. It's not every day that an afro is celebrated, she said. Black hair has long been discriminated against. As a result, starting in the early 1900s, hot tools and chemical relaxants were used to fashion textured hair into a form and shape that better aligned with Eurocentric beauty standards. In a 2019 survey of 2,000 women conducted by Dove, a majority of black women said that they had changed their hair to fit into the workplace and that they felt their natural hair was perceived as unprofessional. It is in only the last few years that states have passed laws to ban hair-based discrimination, often called the Crown Act, an acronym for Create a Respectful and Open Workplace for Natural Hair, though protection still doesn't exist at the federal level. Some people still view the afro as unkempt, said Ms. Martinez, who also posts hair content on social media. Natural hair is a lifestyle. It's not a trend, and it's not something that should be policed. Ahead of the official announcement of the record, Ms. Martinez discussed the feat in an interview that has been edited and condensed for clarity. When did you start leaving your hair in its natural form? My freshman year of college was the very last silk press I ever had. I just didn't feel that it fit me anymore. I had kind of outgrown that style. Then I started to just nurture it back to life by learning how to do braid outs and twist outs. I never did a big chop. I just let the broken hair fall off. Slowly but surely, my curl pattern started to become more and more coily. What was that journey like? My hair has always been a conversation piece. It's like an icebreaker for people. They'll compliment my hair or ask me a question. It's very important to me to wear my natural hair in the workplace and also to encourage other people to do it. When people ask about your hair, can it feel like a microaggression? I can tell the difference between microaggressions and just curiosity. In the past, I've gotten remarks like, ugh, Just looking at all that hair makes me feel anxious, which is obviously about them, not me, right? I've had professors who thought they were helping me by giving me advice around how I should present my hair going into the workplace. I've worked at places where my hair became a conversational piece in a way that didn't feel comfortable, and I ended up leaving. People always want to touch my hair. I think I get it a little bit more than other people do because I feel so comfortable wearing my hair just as it is. But I always come from a space of compassion. I have a lot of experience navigating these situations, so I go into them very calmly, and I'm very thankful for the Crown Act. I do feel a level of comfort knowing there is some form of legislation in place to protect me from hair harassment and discrimination. So what made you want to go after this record? It wasn't on my radar until I posted a video of my afro on Instagram in 2023, and people started commenting, "You should go after the world's largest afro." That's when the seed was planted. I didn't do anything with that idea for about a year or so, and then I thought, you know what? Let me try to challenge myself. So first you have to submit evidence to Guinness that you are even capable of potentially breaking the record. Then there's a 3-month waiting period when they review your application. Once that was approved, I had exactly 1 year to make my attempt. What message are you hoping to send? That people will ultimately come to a space and place where they also feel that their hair is not a burden. I believe the bigger, the better. His comedy drew an official rebuke. He came back fighting. The comedian Veer Das, who has gained international fame despite intense criticism in his native India, has taken up boxing. He says, "It's good prep for adversity." By Alisha Haridasani Gupta. "This is the most terrifying thing I've ever done," the comedian Veer Das said on a crisp, sunny fall Saturday morning earlier this month. That most terrifying thing, he clarified, was working out in front of the New York Times. Because this journalist had decided to tag along for what would otherwise have been his private, routine shadowboxing session with a personal trainer at a hotel gym on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Mr. Das, 46, dressed in an all-black workout set, launched into a warm-up of jumping jacks and high knees while his trainer, Vinny Panza, counted each set. "Deep breaths, easy stuff, 8 more seconds, he told a focus Mr. Das. The gym was about as unassuming as you'd imagine a hotel gym to be. A few other patrons trickled in to jog on the treadmills and plank on the floor. "It's nice to be out of breath and a little bruised," Mr. Das said after his warm-up, while getting his hands wrapped by Mr. Panza. "It's good prep for adversity." Adversity isn't a new concept to Mr. Das, who has the unique distinction of having his comedy result in an international Emmy for one set, an official rebuke from the Indian Parliament on national television for another. He has amassed a vast fan base in India, but his jokes also translate globally, tackling far-ranging topics like Britain's exit from the European Union. They ruled the entire world. This isn't the first Brexit to happen in history, ladies and gentlemen. It's just the first intentional one. The Trump administration and the New York mayoral race. He jokes about how, as a brown man with a beard, he has routinely been mistaken for the city's mayor-elect, Zoran Mamdani. This newspaper once described him as embodying the globalization of stand-up, and his career has included 3 world tours in the last 4 years, with a series of sold-out shows, including recent ones at Carnegie Hall. He is a Bollywood actor, sometimes a Hollywood actor too, a singer in a rock band called Alien Chutney, and as of earlier this month, an author, thanks to The Outsider, a memoir for misfits, in which he describes a globe-stretching life that took him from Lagos, Nigeria, where he grew up, to northern India, Illinois, Alabama, and back to India, yet never quite belonged anywhere. Despite all that, it is a roughly 7-minute YouTube video of one of his bits at the Kennedy Center in Washington in 2021 that has come to crystallize much of his career arc. In it, he poetically lays out all of the cultural, political, social, and religious dichotomies of India. Each line follows more or less the same format. I come from an India that has the largest working population under 30 on the planet, but still listens to 75-year-old leaders with 150-year-old ideas. Or, I come from an India where we take pride in being vegetarians and yet run over the farmers who grow our vegetables. Or, most controversially, I come from an India where we worship women during the day and gang rape them at night. He called it, I come from two Indias. He didn't think much of it. He posted the video on YouTube and then headed to New York with his wife to attend the International Emmy Awards, where he was nominated for one of his Netflix specials. He lost to the hit French show Call My Agent. Meanwhile, back in India, where a slide into nationalistic politics has led to crackdowns on dissent, his clip whipped up a storm. It garnered almost 7 million views and was picked up by countless news organizations. Politicians filed police cases against him for vilifying the nation on foreign soil. One state lawmaker banned him from entering that state. They named him a traitor and a terrorist. By the time he got on his flight back to Mumbai, there was a very real chance he could be arrested upon arrival. My lawyer is like, we'll see what happens, he said. So she's on standby. And then I have that conversation with my wife. You know, like, if I get arrested, this is where all the money is. Just have this much left over for legal fees. Here's all my cards. Here's everything, all the logins. He wasn't arrested, but he and his family received tens of thousands of death threats, and they secluded themselves for several months in the beachside town of Goa, where Mr. Das has previously moved in order to escape COVID-19 lockdowns in Mumbai. At one point, he said, he contemplated suicide. All of his film projects and stand-up gigs dried up. In the midst of the madness, Mr. Das fixated on one aspect of the accusations that he found somewhat funny, that he had embarrassed the country on foreign soil. What if, he wondered, he had said the same jokes on Indian soil? It is a question that became the genesis for his next Netflix special, Veer Das, Landing, which was filmed in 2022 in New York City. In it, his jokes are as unfettered as usual, the only difference being that one part of the stage is blanketed in a layer of sand from a beach in Mumbai. Every time he criticized or joked about India, he would hop onto that part of the stage. It won him an Emmy. In many ways, the ordeal backfired spectacularly for those who wanted to silence him and instead lent him some cachet, he said. It molded my comedic voice, he said, and it gave me a deep connection with my audience. India's embraced me, he added. I have a massive audience. They just don't own news channels, you know what I mean? Mr. Das started pursuing boxing before the hoopla, during the lockdowns in Goa, and has kept it up since. It became a steadying force in his life. Back in Mumbai, he would have a trainer come to the balcony of his apartment. And when we met, he was in New York for a 2-week residency at the Lincoln Center Theater, the first time a comedian has had a residency there. And he had hired Mr. Panza to keep him on track with his fitness. After the warm-up, Mr. Das moved on to punching and ducking, then rounds of jabs, crosses, and hooks. Chin down, fully extend your hands, Mr. Panza said. Keep that right foot on the ground. By the end of roughly 45 minutes of the pair dancing around each other with quick, sharp moves, Mr. Das was winded, leaning on the weights rack for support. Come on, you're only a few years older than me, Mr. Panza said. True, Mr. Das shot back, but I have jet lag. Why are young men embracing the quarter-zip lifestyle? How one of the stodgiest garments in the Western wardrobe caught on with the Nike tech crowd. By Sandra E. Garcia. 2 weeks ago, Jason Jimafi pulled on a sweater, held out his arm, and declared a major life change. In a front-facing video that has well over a million likes on TikTok, Mr. Jimafi, 21, looks into the camera and explains that he will no longer be wearing his former go-to sweatsuits. "I don't do that Nike Tech stuff that y'all little boys do," Mr. Jimafi said in the video, as he smooths out his navy quarter-zip sweater, a style that hasn't been favored by the fashion-conscious set for years. "I'm elegant. I'm classy, feel me? Like you can't take me somewhere. I look presentable." Almost overnight, there were young men at malls, meeting up in parking lots, hanging out on their school campus. Men who might have previously been wearing sweatsuits, loungewear, or Nike Tech suits, all sporting quarter-zip sweaters. T-Pain posted a picture on Instagram in a similar knitted sweater with the caption, "401k and a quarter-zip." "I really got tired of wearing the Nike Tech," Mr. Jimafi, who is from the Bronx and recently graduated from Allegheny College with a degree in computer science, said in an interview. "After a certain point, when that frontal lobe starts developing, you're like, why am I still wearing it?" For generations, teenagers have looked for ways to signal to society that they had grown up. The long-haired, bell-bottom-wearing, fringe-trimmed teens of the 1960s and 70s eventually morphed into the power suit-wearing yuppies of the 80s. Now it seems the time has come for Gen Z to lean into business casual, and the often ribbed, always square, quarter-zip sweater seems to be their garment of choice. The shift from the Nike Tech fleece sweatsuit, an athletic-looking ensemble made of a polyester cotton blend and favored by many Gen Z men, to the classic quarter-zip signifies an aesthetic pivot towards the expectations of the professional world. When Josh Akinwunmi, 22, decided he wanted to try a different look, it was to change the way his clothes made him feel, not the way he was received. He was ready to hold himself in a different regard. According to Mr. Akinwunmi, a student at the University of Texas in San Antonio, Nike Tech wearers have a reputation for being a little rowdy, but all that can change as soon as they zip into a new life. "It is almost not even necessarily telling our young generation to put down the Nike Techs and to pick up a quarter zip, but to just hold yourself to a higher standard," he said. "Dress for success." Mr. Akinwunmi's twin brother, Peter Akinwunmi, who is studying at the University of Houston, agreed, saying that a style reset had the capacity to change not only the outward-facing impression, but also how a man feels about himself. "We really picked up this movement about the quarter zips and more elegant wear because it really helps mentally as well as physically to express growth and personal development," he said. Sayam Hashimi, 21, said Mr. Jamfi's video reached him at just the right time. A recent Virginia Tech graduate, Mr. Hashimi had been going to job interviews and felt it was time for him to elevate his everyday wear. "I'm not going to lie. When I saw it was blowing up, I went to Old Navy. I got a couple of half zips," Mr. Hashimi said. "I'm just kind of doing that transition from being a college kid, and we've got to be a little more business casual now." On Sunday, Mr. Hashimi organized a gathering at a local shopping center in Northern Virginia that he called the DMV Quarter-Zip Meetup. He estimated that some 70 people came out wearing their quarter zips. "I was at the mall the other day and some kid was wearing a half zip, and we looked at each other and kind of both laughed," Mr. Hashimi said. "It's literally starting a whole movement." Many attendees were also carrying matcha drinks to round out the look. "It is meant to signify maturity. Not quite ready for black coffee, but definitely not chugging soda." Mr. Hashimi conceded that the beverage aspect of the look was a bit performative. You've got that professional business casual look with the matcha. It creates a whole different vibe, said Mr. Hashimi, who said his quarter zip style icon was Shah Rukh Khan. It's a funny way of reinventing yourself. For all his talk of personal reinvention, Mr. Jia Mafi said it would be unwise to read too much into any pivot. I don't think necessarily there's a difference between wearing a Nike Tech or a quarter zip because the clothes don't make the man. The man makes the clothes, he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The potato shoe theory. When it comes to footwear, there is one perfect shape, and we're living in the golden era for it. By Jacob Gallagher. Picture a hardy russet, Spartan, and ovoid. It curves swell like a Botero sculpture. Its sides bulge like a raft. Enlarge it once or twice, and this potato could perfectly fit your foot. If this sounds like a peculiar metric for a successful shoe, consider the cornucopia of tuberous footwear already available. What is the UGG slipper? Perennial favorite of surfers, sorority girls, and more recently high fashion fans. If not a Yukon Gold with especially fluffy insides. And tell me that Birkenstock's classic suede Boston clog doesn't look just like a German butterball plucked from the garden. Several examples from my own shoe collection could be described as suitably yammy, reflecting the bumper crop of bulbous shoes that have hit the market in the past half decade. There are deep chestnut clogs from the Spanish luxury house Lowe, and wide-set slip-ons from the Finnish comfort shoe brand Vaibai. Still, my hunger for this shape remains insatiable. When images of new brown-as-dirt mules from the Los Angeles luxury label ERL hit my inbox last month, I caught my cursor hovering over the Add to Bag button. Just as hemlines rise and fall to reflect the mores of that moment, so too do shoes swing from pointy to paunchy. There's a long-standing tradition of potato-like shoes to address concerns of health and comfort, according to Elizabeth Semmelhack, the director and senior curator at the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto. She said wider shapes often begin to show up once footwear became cruelly restrictive. Around the suffragist movement of the 1910s and early 20s, for example, women wore lace-up boots with stubby bulldog nose toes, a middle toe aimed at the very, very pointy high heels that came before. Today's potato shoes, Ms. Semmelhack speculated, are more closely related to the orthopedic styles of the 70s. As organic grocers and yoga studios bloomed in America during this decade, shoppers were charmed by footwear that might somehow improve their well-being. That big one was the Earth Shoe, a quaggy Danish import with a footbed like mashed potatoes. In 1973, Earth Shoe's sales hit 2.5 million. The college crowd first discovered the shoes 3 years ago and was attracted to their back-to-nature appearance, noted a New York Times article in 1974 on the Earth Shoe's success. The Earth Shoe faded in time, but fresh rotund designs kept appearing. A 1994 Times article called The Nike Air Mock, a cinchable laceless bag for your foot, a potato shoe. This frumpy foot sack was everything an Air Jordan was not. That same decade, skateboard brands like DC, Etnies, and Globe began marketing ludicrously large sneakers. They arrived as a seemingly alternative to the UR skate shoe, Gossamer Vans slip-ons. Designed to cushion the wearer's foot, these sneakers look like baked potatoes, seconds from eruption. This moment, though, makes all previous potato shoe boomlets feel like blips and epitomizes the triumph of comfort over hype. It traces back to the pandemic. Shuffling around in their suddenly shrunken universes, unsure of when a return to the real world might come, shoppers began craving shoes that were easy on their feet and easier on their mind. They embraced the slip-on potato-shaped shoe. In 2020, Hypebeast, a streetwear news site known for salivating over Jordans and Dunks, hailed Birkenstock Bostons as the perfect shoe of the moment. 2 years later, interest in the shoes hadn't cooled as they landed at number two on the list index's hottest products. The Boston is the archetype, said Gian De Leon, the men's fashion director at Nordstrom, who on the side operates Mule Boys, an Instagram account which since 2017 has cataloged the deluge of don't-think-twice slip-on shoes. The Boston was but one ugly duckling termed Prong King by the pandemic. Sales of $50 Crocs peaked during 2021. Today, collaborations with designers and cultural properties like the British fashion label Simone Rocha and South Park continue to keep Crocs in the conversation. It's just comfort and convenience, said Mr. De Leon, summing up the prevailing mood of this period. As more imitators have emerged, a barrage of dupes have pushed Birkenstock to invent fresh varieties of its clog. They now offer the Naples, a backless shoe, with the across-the-toe panel of a penny loafer, as well as Boston's Fit for Chefs, with pronounced rubber soles. A shearling-lined version of the Boston's vie with Uggs. Thibaut Denis, a French designer who works for Louis Vuitton, is one of a slew of collaborators who worked with Birkenstock on new designs for its higher-end 1774 line. It was a dream opportunity, he said. Mr. Denis, who says he has always felt a pull towards exaggerated footwear, said a jumbo-scale shoe not only finishes your silhouette, it gives the character of your silhouette. Released this fall, his Birkenstock partnership includes a lumbering suede clog that looks like a potato with laces. Now that it's out in the world, Mr. Denis wishes it bulged even a bit wider around his size 9 feet. I don't want to be interpreted as an oversized designer, Mr. Denis said, but the foot needs space. To keep shoppers spending, brands and designers began pushing the boundaries of what a puffy shoe could look like. A lot of it is based on the very shallow pool of trend research, where it's like, hey, everybody's wearing these wider shoes, let's do some, said Dal Choda, a lecturer of fashion communication at Central St. Martin's University in London. To his eyes, Kanye West's Yeezy Foam Runner, which debuted in June 2020, remains influential. Those long and lumpy shoes in Dune, like shades, felt so organic, but in a way that didn't feel dainty, Mr. Choda said. Not all brands have been so conceptual. Mostly, what we've seen in recent years is a series of Birkenstock Boston clones. Prada, Brunello, Cucinelli, Isabel Marant, Fendi, and Burberry have offered Squint and their similar mules. Lululemon sells a russet clog, as do Shine, Steve Madden, and Quince. So how did I get pulled to the potato shoe? You could say I was primed for it. As a teenager, I relished my fat-tongued America skate shoes and the Birkenstocks that made my disproportionately large feet look even blockier. After college, I gave them up, until, of course, the pandemic. Idling at home, I too bought Bostons and tuned in as the footwear industry sidelined sneakers in favor of fat clogs. I watched Instagram accounts that once posted about the next Adidas Ultra Boost devote attention to gorpy slip-ons. they hyped slope-soled recovery clogs by UFOS, the Japanese brand Subu's inflated slippers, tiny puffer jackets for your feet, and Keen's shanty slides. Intrigued, I bought the latter. When I wore them, my feet looked like they were being attacked by a xenomorph. I loved them. Why, I wondered, had I been squeezing my feet into stubborn dress shoes all this time? I sold off my double monks and lace-ups, confident that I could replace them when the inevitable return to the real world arrived. I did, with expansive low loafers that allow my toes to sprawl. Recently, though, I've noticed the counterpush towards shoes that are thin, slender, and barely there. We are witnessing another one of those reactive trend fluctuations that Miss Semmelhack studied. Retro shoes of the 70s, like wafer-thin Adidas Sambas and Onitsuka Tigers, are being billed by fashion publications as the big thing. So-named ballerina sneakers are on offer from designer brands like Ralph Lauren and Prada. I am only human, and I too can fall victim to trends. So I bought a pair of wispy dries Van Noten sneakers with a sole that couldn't have been more than a centimeter thick. When I wore them, I could feel every pebble I passed over. My heel hurt from impact. The next day, I went back to my potato shoes. Modern love. The three times I married my wife. Saying wedding vows is one thing. Living up to them is quite another. By Brent Chaim Spodek. The first time I married my wife, she was wearing a big white dress and all our friends and family were there. The second time I married my wife, she wasn't even in the room, though her mother was. The third time I married my wife, it was just the two of us and our teenage children in the woods. At the big white dress wedding, Allison and I were 25 and working hard to be the adults we thought we were supposed to become. I had just returned from a year studying in Israel and decided that, despite a lifetime of distance from Judaism, I was now very religious. So I wore a traditional white wedding robe, leading my mother to shout, "You look like a butcher!" She wasn't wrong. I was focused on the story of our ritual, which texts the rabbi would recite, how to make the ceremony egalitarian in a tradition that wasn't. An employee helping with the outdoor ceremony saw something I didn't. My wife's bare hands wrapped around a bouquet on an unseasonably frigid autumn day and slipped her a hand warmer. I was focused on the ceremony. He was focused on the human being. The second time I married my wife, she was hooked up to IVs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in Manhattan, her skin gray from chemotherapy. I was at our home, 75 miles away, caring for our two small children. I had tremendous help from my mother-in-law, Hazel, who was also giving us her 10-year-old Toyota Corolla. Hazel thought her daughter's name should also be on the title. I thought Allison, who had been diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia 6 months earlier, did not need to be bothered with paperwork. "It has to be in both your names," Hazel said. "I'm not giving the car to just you." "Hazel," I said, "if I were going to leave, I'd have done it already. You think I'm sticking around for the Corolla?" But the truth was, part of me did want to leave. I was frantic and exhausted. After putting the children to bed, I would sit on the porch, drink scotch, and cry until I passed out. I couldn't imagine the rest of my life as a widowed father of two children under six. I thought I had committed to Allison at our wedding 12 years earlier, but in truth, I had committed to an idea, a vision of who she was supposed to be, and who I was supposed to be, and what our life together was supposed to be. That vision didn't include her being bald and emaciated or me being half-drunk and terrified. It wasn't until that vision crumbled that I really married her. Not a vision against which I could and did judge my wife, but my actual flesh and blood wife, whose flesh was withering and whose blood was attacking her. I wasn't really married until I desperately wanted to walk out of my life and didn't. Neither of us realized it at the time, but the most important part of the white dress wedding was a line we had added to our ketubah, the Jewish marriage covenant. We agree to create a separate time and space each year, we wrote, in the season of our betrothal, to stand amid the love and mistakes of the year that has passed and make a reckoning of it and to look to the time to come. We had lived up to that even before the leukemia. Every autumn, Allison and I had a mini retreat on the state of our marriage. We talked about the love and the mistakes and the year that had passed, writing it all down in a little black journal we picked up in an airport. We love each other so much and still work to know that in the deepest parts of ourselves. We wrote in 2024, a year after her successful bone marrow transplant. When Allison got released from the hospital, we threw a giant party complete with a contraband and bouncy castle. Our neighborhood bar donated 2 kegs of beer, and it seemed like our entire small town came out to celebrate the doctor's pronouncement. Cured! It was glorious. Her hair was growing out. Her blood was once again ferrying oxygen throughout her body. Most importantly, her immune system could tolerate being around our children and their germs. We were overjoyed. But we were also wrecked. Allison had been afraid of dying. And I had been afraid of her dying. Related fears, but not the same. Now we were back in the same house, sleeping in the same bed, but felt galaxies apart. There were times I feared that we had made it through hell only to get divorced on the other side. We've gotten so much better at accepting each other's human imperfections, though there is always more work to be done, we wrote in 2016. Those mini retreats saved us. 2 years after Allison's return home, we rented a little cabin with pop art Buddhas in western Massachusetts. Walking endless loops of Great Barrington, we opened the vaults we hadn't realized we were carrying. Resentments about compromises we had made for each other's careers. About the balance of challenging and comforting our children. About how we navigated the darkest days of her illness. If Great Barrington had a 24-hour divorce lawyer, we probably would have stopped in. Instead, we kept talking. Somewhere in those endless loops, something cracked. We began to see what we hadn't before, that each of us is starring in our own movie. In my movie, I was the director, writer, lead, and sole audience member, and Allison was a supporting character. I knew what she was supposed to say and got frustrated when she botched her lines. In Allison's movie, I was the one screwing up my lines. Before she got sick when we thought we were both in the same movie, we believed we had a happy marriage. We did, but we were also just lucky. We didn't really get married until our luck ran out. The annual retreat we had vowed in our ketubah wasn't enough. Returning from Great Barrington, we started taking walks 3 times a week just to talk. It sounds like a lot, and it was. Eventually, we cut back to once a week, always starting with the same 2 questions. When have you felt close to me this week, and when have you felt distant? We each stopped insisting that our movie was the right one and started learning to hit pause and watch each other's movie for a while. We learned there was a gap, sometimes a chasm, between our intent and the impact we had on each other. We learned that not naming our feelings or desires was not flexibility but cowardice. We learned how one flawsome person, someone who is both flawed and awesome, can love and be loved by another flawsome person. We also learned how to actually articulate our convoluted psyches so that our partner would have a chance of understanding the plot of our movie. We learned how to be married to a person, not an idea. Last fall, 23 years after the big white dress wedding, we returned to Western Massachusetts for our anniversary and began writing a new ketubah for what our marriage is about now. We worked on that document for nearly a year, and a few months ago, we married for the third time. We had those promises printed as a work of art and took them into the forest behind our house. No white wedding dress, no big party, no commitment to a specific vision of the life we were building, just one flossom person committing to another. We promised to stop blaming each other for our own foibles and to each take responsibility for living our own lives fully and authentically. We promised to stop holding on to every slight as if it were a gemstone and welcome invitations to laugh at our hang-ups. We promised to remember that our marriage isn't something we have, but something we make every day with every decision. With our teenagers as reluctant, if gracious, witnesses, we made promises with more specificity than we could have imagined half a lifetime ago. We committed to the partners we actually have and love, not the movie director's idea of who they should be. We finally understood that marriage isn't one vow spoken one time, but thousands of small recommitments to reality over fantasy. It is not, I suspect, our last marriage, but it's been the best one so far. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 30th issue of the New York Times Style section. Your reader has been Laura. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 3 of Boat Baby by Vicky Nguyen. Stay with us for these readings and more. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, broadcasting daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, and books to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. Radio Reading's broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga between William and Clinton Streets. Radio Reading's website is nfradioreading.org. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call us at 716-821-5555.